good horse, I called you my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 599 of Unwelcome Guests. What economics can't tell you about money? I'm Robin Upton, and this episode's title is the title of a presentation I made last year, which I shall be presenting after our first speaker. We're looking at money this week, but we're getting well beyond the traditional frames which are within the economic model. We're not looking at numbers, we're not looking at imports, exports, any of traditional economic theory. Instead, we're looking at what is the impact of the money system on the world? How does it affect the individual who uses it? What does it do to the society which embraces it as an organizing principle? Our first and third pieces are larger pictures, and the presentation that I'll be speaking about looks at the effect on the individual. It's a compilation of different bits of research on how money affects decision making, and it tries to make a bigger picture about its effect on the psyche. We begin with an interview from KPFA's Against the Grain with Arizona State University English professor David Hawkes. Now, if you remember David Graeber speaking about how the colonialists inveigled the Nigerian leaders to give up their traditional positions of power in local value systems, basically sucked them into a sort of pyramid scheme type cult, where over a period of a few generations their position worsened and they ended up selling members of their village, even family members, into slavery to be taken to America to advance their position in this cult. I think it's worth bearing that in mind as we listen to David Hawkes talking about magic and money as a symbol. And I must say I'm attracted to his notion that in the past there was a proletariat, people who worked, sold themselves for money, and a bourgeoisie, people who collected income and lived off the back of the proletariat, but that nowadays the majority of people are simultaneously the one and the other, divided into those times, parts of the day, when they're selling themselves for money, and they are assuming the slave role, and those times when they are spending money and assuming the bourgeoisie role, the command role, seeking to profit from investments. In the decade or so since I've been putting forward alternative economic systems, I've identified a kind of Stockholm syndrome whereby many people criticize the money system. They recognize, yep, I'm basically a wage slave. I do things that I don't believe in for the sake of this imaginary thing called money. And yet the same people are even hostile, certainly critical, when the idea of fundamental reforms take place. Now, I understand this as, okay, so my job makes me do lots of things I don't like, but it feeds me. I get money and I pay for food with the money. People are, because they are, when they talk about this subject, quite nervous and vulnerable, they clutch at the idea of spending money, that moment of being in command, as if this is giving them real power, the way that we might see a cheap product as a good deal because we choose to neglect the fact that it's made by sweatshop workers somewhere else in the world. I think this is some of the allure of money, that it allows people to feel good about cutting themselves off from the consequences of their actions. And that's also, of course, one of the fatal flaws, and that's why I think we should be making earnest efforts to get out of the money system, both on an individual level, and we should be having a larger discussion as a society. And now let's hear the interview Thank you to C.S. Soong for this. His voice is the one that you shall hear next.
The goal of the Enlightenment, we are told, was to sweep away beliefs rooted in magic and superstition and to replace them with rational analysis and scientific method. But how much of our economy, how much of the global economy, is rooted in belief, in tightly held beliefs about symbols and signs? Take money, for example. We believe money has value, and therefore it does. According to David Hawkes, something called ideology is at play here, without which money and lending and finance could not operate, let alone dominate today's world. David Hawkes has a long-standing interest in money as a symbol that takes on a life of its own, that acquires a kind of subjective power, even though, on the face of it, it's only a thing, a material coin or bill. The Arizona State University professor also draws important connections between money and human labor, and he has much to say about a distinction that goes back to Aristotle, that between a thing's use value and its exchange value. David Hawkes is the author of a number of books, including Ideology and The Faust Myth, Religion and the Rise of Representation. When he joined me from Arizona, I asked him about money and from where it derives its power.
Yes, it derives its power from its exchangeability. What money really is a symbol which represents human labor power or human life activity. And over the course of money's history, this fact, the fact that money is a mere symbol, has been gradually revealed to the people who use money.
In what ways is money a symbol of human labor power?
Well, when we want to exchange two objects that are qualitatively different from each other, let's say, for example, a pen and a watch, if we want to do that on any large scale, any scale above the level of barter, we need a common denominator, some factor in which the value of both the pen and the watch can be expressed. The only possible common denominator in which the value of anything can be expressed is human activity, because human activity is necessary for the production of anything. The fact that both the pen and the watch are the products of human activity is a characteristic that they share in common, and which therefore enables their values to be expressed in the same terms. Therefore, for any large-scale system of market exchange to be possible, some form of money must be brought into existence.
So humans do work, they create certain things, and you have written that humans give up a portion of their life in terms of their labor and their labor effort and their labor time in exchange for a symbol of that work, of that labor, of that time. Is that symbol money?
Yes. The system of wage labor, which is historically fairly recent, at least universal wage labor, whereby almost everyone in our society exchanges 40 or 50 hours of their lives every week for a determinate amount of money. When this becomes the universal economic system, people become used to conceiving of themselves as commodities. They become used to conceiving of their time as a thing that can be sold for money on the market. So they become used to making an equivalence between themselves, basically, between their activity, themselves, what they do, and its symbolic or financial expression. They become used to translating themselves into symbolic form.
So when humans begin to see themselves as commodities, as things, this is an example, I believe, of what you refer to in your writings as the objectification of the subject, correct?
Yes. If there is such a thing as experience, which I think we can agree there is, then there must be something that has that experience, which we call the subject of experience. And there must also be something that is experienced, which we call the object of experience. And what happens in the system of wage labor, which also involves the reproduction of money, the autonomous reproduction of this symbolic form of human activity, which used to be called usury and today is called interest. In such a system, the subjective side of experience is made into an objective phenomenon, as human activity, which is subjective, is systematically translated into the external objective form of financial value. Simultaneously, financial value or money, which is in reality objective, it's not alive, it's a thing, but when we ascribe it the power to reproduce, as in usury or interest-bearing capital, then that objective thing becomes subjective. It becomes alive, if you like. This is why all the religions and all the systems of philosophy in human history have prohibited usury. They've all said that usury is unnatural and unethical, because it takes something which is naturally dead, money, an object, and it treats it as though it were alive. It allows it to reproduce, to breed, as if it were a living thing. And when money becomes a living thing, it acquires the attributes of a living thing. It acquires needs and desires and impulses and interests, as all living things do. But in the case of money, those needs, desires, impulses and interests may well contradict the needs, desires, interests and impulses of those human beings whose activity it represents.
Give me an example.
For example, the requirements of profit, let's say in a factory, the requirements of profit may dictate that the factory should be shut down in the USA and moved to Mexico, where labor costs are cheaper. Now, that is against the interests of the people who work in the factory in the USA. They're going to lose their jobs. And yet, they're going to lose their jobs because their own interests have been sacrificed to the interests of capital. And capital is nothing more than the externalized symbolic form of their own activity. So they've sacrificed their real selves, their real lives, to an external representation of their lives. The interests of money have become more important than the interests of the people whose activity the money represents.
So when you say that money acquires the attributes of living things, it attains a certain subjective power, even though it is an object, a thing, then that suggests to me that it only acquires such attributes if we give it such attributes, if there's something about our belief systems or our imaginations that allows money, that permits money to attain that power and acquire those attributes.
That's right, yes. It wouldn't have any power unless human beings collectively agreed to give it that power. Of course, the proviso, though, is that this is a collective agreement. There's nothing that any individual can do to opt out of this. I can't turn around tomorrow and say, well, I don't believe in money anymore, so it doesn't exist for me. That's not going to work. The illusion is collective, but you're absolutely right that it is an illusion. Money is a human invention, and it has no existence outside of the human mind. Although it is the most powerful force in the world, and it dictates the policies of nations and the lives of individuals, money has no material existence. It only exists in the human mind. When you stop to think about it, it's quite remarkable that something that has no material existence at all should be so overwhelmingly powerful.
Let me read a passage here from an article you wrote a few years back called Faust Among the Witches, and I think it sums up what we've been talking about very eloquently. The person gives up a portion of his life in exchange for a symbol of that portion. This symbol, which is money, then attains a subjective power so that it determines the lives of the people whose activity it represents. A money economy is one in which people are ruled by a fetishized representation of their own selves. Market economies are ruled by this ghostly, dead, but supernaturally active power called money. Let's talk more about workers and working. So there's a word often used to describe the kind of the state, the mental state, the existential state of workers, and that is alienation. What is alienating about working to make money as opposed to working for the primary purpose of, say, creating something?
It has to do with the nature of what money is. When we work for money, what we are doing is building up this alien representation, this projection of our own activity. The more we work, the more we're translating our real selves, our actual life activity, into the illusory, externalized, alienated, symbolic form of our life activity, which is capital. One idea of Marx's that's quite difficult for people to grasp, it's called the immiseration thesis. And Marx talks about how the more the worker works, the more alienated he becomes. And paradoxically, the more profitable the enterprise for which he works becomes, the more alienated the worker is from his labor. Profit for the worker becomes alienation. Well, how should this be so? Because you might think that the worker would also profit along with the capitalist for whom he is working. Well, it can only be the case that increased profit brings increased misery for the worker if we remember what that profit represents. That profit is the worker's self. Now, I don't mean that it's the self of any one particular worker, but all capital is alienated labor power in symbolic form. So all profit has been taken from a worker, and it exists in an alien and often hostile relationship to the collective workers whose activity it represents.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. David Hawks joins us. He's a professor of English at Arizona State University. He's author of a number of books, including Idols of the Marketplace, Ideology, and The Culture of Usury in Renaissance England. He joins us from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. When you talk about workers' selves, workers' lives, are we overshooting things a bit? Because labor, while making up a large part of the life of almost every worker, isn't the entire self, the entire life of a person.
No, that's true, but nevertheless, what the worker sells is his life. He may sell it piecemeal. He may only sell 40 or 50 hours of it per week. But nevertheless, that is what he is selling. This is a mistake that some people make when they think about the labor theory of value, is to think that the worker is selling his labor, right? That he's selling the tasks that he is performing, that this is the commodity that's exchanged. Well, that isn't actually the case in a system of wage labor. In a system of wage labor, what the worker sells is his time, right? He gets paid the same no matter what he does at work, as long as he remains there for a particular amount of time. Well, our time is indistinguishable from our lives. So when we sell our time, we are selling our lives, and our lives are indistinguishable from ourselves. We are selling ourselves, although we're selling it ourselves piecemeal and 40 or 50 hours a week only. Nevertheless, the principle is the same. We are exchanging ourselves for money just as surely as a slave is exchanged for money, just not to the same extent. It's interesting, actually, the psychological effects that ancient thinkers like Aristotle ascribe to slaves, which they see as the product of slavery. These psychological effects are also, I think, characteristic of proletarians. Selling oneself even piecemeal, as a proletarian does, for 40 or 50 hours a week, seems to have many of the same psychological effects as slavery is traditionally supposed to have had. Preeminent among these would be materialism. If you read ancient Greek drama or the thought of Aristotle, or treatments of slavery going all the way up to W.E.B. Du Bois and his book The Souls of Black Folks, we find that slaves are associated with sensual pleasure. The only incentives they respond to, allegedly, is sensual pleasure and corporal punishment. In the ancient world, corporal punishment was reserved for slaves because it was felt that they only responded to physical stimuli, whether that was negative or positive. And I think a similar kind of materialist outlook on the world arises in societies like our own, which are characterized by virtually universal wage labor. Like slavery, wage labor seems to produce a materialist outlook on the world, and I think the fact that we live in a society of near universal wage labor goes a long way towards explaining the kind of popular materialism, which I think is the kind of default outlook which most people today have on the world.
Well, you've been referring to the materialism of the age, and yet we started this conversation by talking about the power of money and money being a symbol, quite different from a material thing. So how do we square this prevalent materialism, this notion of a predominant materialism in today's world, with the fact that we have ascribed so much power to a symbol, to an idea?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. Is money an idea? Is it a symbol or is it a thing? I mean, I'm not sure that that's a question that's all that easy to answer. One thing that's certainly true is that it's objective, right? It's something outside of ourselves. It's something different from ourselves. Therefore, when we translate ourselves into the form of money, we can, I think, talk about the objectification of the subject. We're taking what is subject and we are externalizing it, alienating it. We might almost say projecting it outside of ourselves. So even if we don't think of money as a material, physical thing, it's certainly an objective entity.
So it's an objective entity, and it has a certain kind of subjective power. So maybe I could just follow up and push you a little further on the power then of the symbol in relation to the power of materialism as something we all ascribe to, it seems.
Well, everyone has to recognize the power of the symbol of money, right? Even if we believe that that power is magical or superstitious, as I think it is. I think it's fetishistic. It's similar to the kind of power that people might ascribe to religious icons. It's a symbol which does things. Marx compares it to the sorcerer's apprentice, where the pots and pans get up and start running around. So everyone is forced to acknowledge that power. They can't live in postmodern society unless they do. And I think that does contribute to the widespread materialism of the age, because it suggests that only objective factors, or only objective entities, are efficacious. Only objective entities have real power.
Well, one thing you've written about a lot is magic and witchcraft, particularly in colonial nations and then post-colonial nations. In what sense have you tried to juxtapose this belief in, say, the symbolic, the belief in Western society, I should say, of the symbolic, the belief in symbols like money and money's circulation in finance, with beliefs in magic and in witchcraft in indigenous societies?
Yes, this is very interesting. It seems that in societies that are newly being introduced to a market economy and are newly being exposed to the power of money for the first time, in such societies, there seems to be a rise in belief in magic and witchcraft. And very often there are witch hunts or witch crazes. in which the power of evil supernatural forces is perceived to be on the rise. This happens in 16th and 17th century Europe. When capitalism is in its germinal phases in Europe, of course, there's this enormous witch hunt, which takes place between 1550 and 1650, approximately, in Europe. It becomes clear that people are achieving power by non-traditional means. A capitalist society is a society in which social mobility is a visible phenomenon. When this is new, people become confused, and it's not clear how this social mobility is possible. It's not clear what the sources of non-traditional power are. And very often people become suspicious about the kinds of ways in which people are attaining new forms of power. Now, the same thing seems to happen at the moment in West Africa and parts of South America, which are making a transition from basically a feudal kind of society to a rudimentary capitalist society with wage labor, interest, and so on. And again, we have a resurgence in such societies of witch beliefs, witch trials, witch hunts, and so on. It's actually a very serious problem in parts of the post-colonial world now, where witchcraft has been made illegal again. It was legalized under the colonial state, typically under the misconception that there just was no such thing as witchcraft, and witches simply didn't exist. So there was no point in having laws against them. That illusion has come to an end now, and witchcraft is once again being made illegal. Because it involves very often really, really serious crimes, murder, torture, rape, child abuse, and so on. So there are very good reasons to make witchcraft as such illegal as well. Now, the point of similarity between magic and capitalism is the power that both of them give to symbols. In magic, the witch or the magician tries to use representations, incantations, symbols, icons, fetishes, in order to alter the objective condition of things in the real world, right? That's essentially what magic is, the attempt to use representation to achieve objective effects. And that is also what capitalism does. It takes a medium of representation, money, and it ascribes to it efficacious and performative powers. It allows money to do things. In both cases, we see examples of what the literary theorist J.L. Austin calls performative signs, performative speech acts, as he calls them. That is to say, pieces of representation which actually do achieve things, such as, for example, when the priest says, "I now declare you man and wife." Those words actually do something.
Mm-hmm.
What they mean is not important. What they do is important. And money and the fetishes and icons that are used in magic are signs of a similar nature. They're signs which are not supposed to have reference. They're not supposed to mean things. They're signs which are efficacious, which actually perform acts in the real world.
I'm CS. David Hawks joins me on Against the Grain. On our website, againstthegrain.org, we have a link to his faculty page at Arizona State University, where he is an English professor, as well as to his latest book, The Culture of Usury in Renaissance England. We were talking about a number of things, including an article he wrote entitled Faust Among the Witches, Toward an Ethics of Representation for the journal Early Modern Culture. But Enlightenment came along, and Enlightenment and its legions of followers, weren't they determined to replace magical views of the world with rational perspectives, rational understandings?
They were, very much so, yes. In fact, in Goethe's Faust, there's a wonderfully comic scene where various philosophers inform Mephistopheles that he no longer exists, and dismiss him and tell him to go away. There's no place for him here in this new enlightened world. In fact, this goes back all the way to Christopher Marlowe's version of Dr. Faustus, when Faust is actually talking to Mephistopheles, a visible devil who has just come from hell, and Faust says to his face, "I think hell's a fable." So he refuses to believe the evidence of his own eyes. Yes, I think enlightenment certainly sees itself as sweeping away superstition and replacing it all with rationality. I think, however, we might see this process in a slightly different way. It may be that what seems to be the disappearance of magic from the world, at least from the Western world, we don't kind of experience magic in our everyday lives anymore. At least we don't think we do. But it may be that that disappearance is actually the result of the complete triumph of magic. It may be that there is nothing but magic in the world anymore. And the reason why we don't see it is because we have no vantage point outside it from which we might view it. What I mean, basically, is what we call the economy, which is a recent and arbitrary invention. The notion of the economy was brought into being in the 18th century as a way of rationalizing the kind of self-interested, avaricious, greedy behavior that takes place and is allowed to take place in a market economy.
The sphere of the economy is an invented sphere?
Yeah. The idea that certain actions and certain modes of behavior are, so to speak, economic and others are not. This is an idea that was developed by the early political economists in the late 17th and 18th century. In order to make it permissible to behave in greedy, avaricious, self-interested ways, which until then had been forbidden by ethical and moral systems. The notion of the economy says, okay, there's this area, there's this kind of action which is called economic, and in that area, it's okay to be selfish. It's okay to pursue your rational self-interest. In fact, the economy, we might say, consists of those behaviors in which human beings pursue their rational self-interest in a legitimate form.
And I want to read something you were talking about earlier. I want to read from something you wrote about the Western world and magic. You wrote, "The Western world, too, is ruled by icons, charms, and fetishes. Its inhabitants are frequently confused as to the boundaries between fantasy and reality. Their leisure time is spent in the contemplation of images. They speak easily of the, quote, cult of celebrity. They dedicate their economic lives to the accumulation of the token they call money. They often understand their identities in relation to the goods they consume." And getting back to witchcraft in contemporary Africa, okay, so you have written, and it's pretty widely known, that the people most often convicted of witchcraft in early modern Europe were women, were old women, were destitute or mentally disturbed old women. In contemporary Africa, are witches generally thought to be these kinds of people?
No, in fact, that's a very interesting difference between contemporary Africa and early modern Europe. In contemporary Africa, the people who are most often suspected of witchcraft are so-called big men. That is to say, powerful people, very often nouveau riche, people who've achieved power and riches recently by means which are not always altogether clear. And these people very often achieve significant amount of both economic and political power. For example, Papa Doc Duvalier in Haiti or Idi Amin in Uganda. Politicians such as this derive a significant amount of their power from their reputation as practitioners of magic. So the line, which is very clear in the Western world, between economics and magic is far less clear in the post-colonial world. And I think if you take a step back and think about how the postmodern economy must appear from the outside, I think it's quite easy to understand why it might be perceived as a magical set of phenomena. After all, there are these arcane networks of signs and representations and symbols and so on the shifts in the relationship between various kinds of money have extremely powerful repercussions. They alter the politics of nations. They break apart great alliances such as the EU. And yet nothing materially takes place whatsoever. The factors that drive history in the postmodern world are symbolic. If they're economic, they're symbolic. They are not real in any recognizable sense of the word.
Is this why you write that the back in the colonial era, the colonial power was generally regarded by the colonized as pro-witch?
Yes, because the colonizers didn't believe, or at least said they didn't believe in witchcraft, and so they didn't bother making it illegal. They ignored it, and therefore there was a de facto toleration of witchcraft.
Now, a distinction that I believe goes back to Aristotle is the distinction between a thing's use value and its exchange value. Can you define both terms for us?
Sure. A use value is what something actually does. Let's think again about the example of a watch. The use value of a watch is to tell the time. In a similar fashion, the use value of a pen is to write with. So the use value of an object is inherent in the material body of the object itself. If you don't have the material watch, you can't tell the time. If you don't have the material pen, you can't write. Exchange value is symbolic. Say I want to exchange the watch for the pen. Say I want to do barter and swap the watch for the pen. In order to do that, I must be able to perceive the value of the watch in the physical body of the pen. That pen must be worth a watch to me, right? I must be able to see or perceive or understand that the value of the watch is present in the physical body of the pen.
Mm-hmm.
That value is what we call exchange value. It's not material. It's imaginary. It's symbolic. But nevertheless, it's real. Now, this exchange value is on a large scale, when the economy develops beyond the system of simple barter, this exchange value develops into the common denominator known as money. So this is how money originates, as a symbol. When we extend that beyond a simple barter, exchange value takes on a life of its own, culminating in postmodernism, where money, the medium of the exchange, completely dominates the entire economic system.
And what's the consequence, say, in Aristotle's view, of exchange value kind of running rampant, of triumphing over use value to the extent that money is now seen as a way of making money without necessarily there being any material products or manufactured products as an intermediary?
Aristotle thinks that's terrible. He thinks it's unethical and immoral and, above all, unnatural. Aristotle says that usury is the most hated form of economy, and he says it's most reasonably hated because it's the furthest away from nature. It takes something which is not part of nature, money, and it makes it reproduce as if it were part of nature. For Aristotle, this is a fundamental error, and from that error, all sorts of other philosophical and ethical errors flow. For Aristotle, the purpose of economic activity is to produce things, use values, right? Things that are going to be useful for humanity. The purpose of economic activity is not to produce money. Money is a means, for Aristotle, to the end of producing use values. When money becomes the end, the purpose of an economic act such as exchange, for Aristotle, that is bad and unethical. So when, for example, you use your money to buy a factory and you wait for the factory's value to increase and then you sell the factory at a profit, for Aristotle, you've done something wrong, because you have subordinated the material entity of the factory and the use values that can be produced in the factory, you've subordinated them to the end of financial profit, which finally is nothing at all, right? Financial profit is a set of figures that go into your bank account, but which do not produce anything material, don't produce anything useful. So for Aristotle, for money to be the end of economic activity was wrong, and above all, usury was wrong. By the way, Aristotle is not alone in this. All systems of philosophy, all the great religions in world history, basically every system of thought in human history condemns usury. I think that's something that we would do well to think about, because our society is completely based upon usury. Usury runs our economy. I think it ought to give us pause that every previous system of thought in human history has said that usury is basically the work of the devil.
And to clarify, when you say usury, you are not referring to lending at an exorbitant or illegally high rate. You're talking about lending with interest as a generic phenomenon, correct?
Exactly.
So Karl Marx comes along. Was his understanding of exchange value and use value and his ethical judgments about those two kinds of values, were they in any significant way different than Aristotle's?
Well, the big difference was that Marx saw the economic phenomena that Aristotle was describing as incarnated in two particular social classes. And in the 19th century, when Marx was writing, this was to a large extent true. Marx thought that labor power was embodied in the proletariat. That is to say, people who lived by selling themselves for money, wage laborers. That was the proletariat. Also, in Victorian Europe, you have another social class called the bourgeoisie, who live from interest, essentially, who live from capital investments. They are the capitalist class. Now, in 19th century Europe, Marx saw these two classes as confronting each other in a hostile relationship, and he thought that society was ripe for revolution as a result. But actually, the situation in which labor power is incarnated in one social class and capital is incarnated in another social class is a kind of historical accident. This isn't necessarily the state of affairs at all. In our society, for example, almost everybody is a proletarian. In 19th century Europe, the proletariat was a fairly small social class in most countries. In Russia, for example, it was much smaller than the peasantry. But today, almost everybody in Western societies is a proletarian.
In the sense that they put out labor and they get compensated for it.
Exactly. They perform wage labor. Anyone who performs wage labor is a proletarian. Even if their wages are very high, this doesn't have anything to do with wealth. It has to do with your position in the mode of production. So someone who sells their labor for wages is a proletarian, and someone who receives income from capital investments is a bourgeois. And that means that not only is everyone in our society a proletarian, but almost everyone in our society is also and simultaneously a bourgeois, because almost everyone receives some income in the form of interest on capital investments, even if only in the form of a mortgage or a savings account or a pension plan. Right? So everyone is both a proletarian and a bourgeois. And this is the case despite the fact that labor power is the opposite of capital, right? Capital is the externalized, alienated form of labor power. And yet, both labor power and capital are, as it were, embodied in our system within the same individual.
David, is it fair to say, though, that some workers, especially workers with lower wages, may align themselves or affiliate themselves in their own minds and maybe in their daily practices with the working class and thereby see themselves as a group opposed to some very high wage earners who would see their interests as falling in with a capitalist class? Perhaps most of their income comes from investments, from capital investments, from being landlords, from lending money, whatever. So do you see that kind of dichotomy still possibly operating?
Well, certainly there may be a perception that different sections of the working classes may have different interests. That's true. On the other hand, I think that attempts to use labour to fight against capital, right? This is the kind of the way that capitalism was resisted for the first couple of centuries of its history, right? In the 19th and 20th centuries, the way to fight against capital was through organised labour. So the working class would form unions and political parties, and it would attempt to, well, in its radical forms, it would attempt to take back the alienated wealth, which is capital, to retake ownership of that, to expropriate the expropriators, as the phrase went. But these attempts to overthrow capitalism by socialist politics universally failed. They never succeeded. The only socialist revolutions that took place happened in pre-capitalist societies, and they were basically peasant revolutions, not proletarian revolutions at all.
Russia, China,
mm-hmm. Cuba, and so on. Yes, exactly. So the kind of classical idea whereby the proletariat would overthrow the bourgeoisie because labor power is logically contradictory to capital, that never worked out. And in retrospect, I think that socialist politics look more like a kind of desperate last-ditch attempt to resist what has turned out to be the unstoppable conquest of the world by capital.
Well, let me ask you about that, because capitalism is seen as kind of strong and hegemonic and undefeatable in many respects, and yet how strong do you feel it is if it depends so much on what we began talking about, which is money as a symbol in which everyone believes?
Yeah, well, theoretically, it could be abolished in literally the blink of an eye, right? If we all stop believing in it, it no longer exists. So in that sense, it's extremely weak. And I don't find it all that implausible to imagine some kind of mass revelation which might well make capitalism psychologically untenable. I wouldn't like to say what form it might take, but I can easily imagine that as a theoretical possibility. I mean, the other thing to say is that capitalism, because of usury, essentially, is committed to unceasing growth, right? I mean, that's the nature of usury. When you lend someone money, you have to pay them back more than you lent them. So you have to make more money, you have to grow, and that's the basic idea on which capitalism is predicated. Well, when you have a system that's predicated on infinite growth in a world with finite resources, obviously it's not going to work for very long. And, mm-hmm. I mean, that's becoming very clear, I think. So in that sense, capitalism is weak in the sense that it can't last forever and may not even be able to last very much longer. The question is, will we have this revelation that enables us to do away with it before it does away with us?
David Hawkes is his name. He's a professor of English at Arizona State University. His books include Idols of the Marketplace, The Culture of Usury in Renaissance England, and Ideology. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on KPFA Pacifica Radio. If capital and if money rely on people's beliefs about the power of money, for example, about money as a symbol that actually does things in the real world, then what is your sense of people today, their willingness to continue to give such power to money, to give autonomous power to a symbol such as money?
I think the appeal of a society ruled by money is quite easy to understand. What money makes possible is, well, social mobility, but also a kind of psychological mobility. In philosophical terms, I think money is an anti-essentialist power. It challenges the notion that there is an essence within us, we might call it a soul, which makes us what we are, which determines what we are, and about which there isn't much we can do. What money does is it allows us to reinvent ourselves. It allows us to alter our essence, or to suggest that our appearance is more important than our essence. After all, money really is an appearance. Exchange value in general is an appearance that is imposed upon the essential, natural quality of use value. So, in a society which is dominated by money, such as our own, we enter into a condition which postmodernist philosophers like Jean Baudrillard refer to as hyper-reality. That is to say, a society in which there are only signs. There are no referents. There is only exchange value. There is no use value. Now, of course, a sign which doesn't have a referent ceases to be a sign. Right? All signs have reference.
Mm-hmm.
So if we live in this world of depthless simulacra, such as Baudrillard describes, then sign is an inadequate word. What Baudrillard refers to instead is to simulacra. These are depthless signs, pure representation with nothing underneath it. Now, a lot of people find that idea very attractive, the idea that we live in a world with no objective reality, no underlying essence, no ultimate truth, and therefore a world which it's possible constantly to reinvent, and in which it's possible to change one's role. For example, a lot of feminists and queer theorists find postmodernism and the postmodern condition to be intensely liberating. Mm. Because they say, well, gender, for example, is not an essential quality of a human being. It's a network of symbols and signs and representations. It's a construction. And therefore, it can be changed if we want to change it. Or if I want to change it personally, I can change it.
There's a kind of a fluidity, a hybridity that people find attractive.
Precisely. People find it attractive to think that their identity is fluid and malleable. A lot of people find this very liberating, the idea that you don't have to be what you are. You can remake yourself and be something completely different. And not just that, but the entire world can do this. There is no ultimate truth. There is no God, if you like. And therefore, everything is up for grabs. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why people find a market economy to be exciting. But I think that we have to remember that according to the standards of all previous human systems of morality, a market economy, especially one dominated by usury, is ethically very, very problematic indeed.
And is that problematic nature of usury and of a market economy, do you feel like that has acquired some steam among ordinary folks?
I think it has recently, yes, since the credit crunch. I think people are reawakening to ancient objections to usury, really. I mean, if you read the economic literature that's produced at the very beginning of market capitalism in 16th and 17th century England, you find a universal hatred of the usurer. The usurer is a folk devil, and usury is universally agreed to be a destructive and evil and literally satanic force. And this was kind of common knowledge, commonly accepted folk wisdom. It took an awful long time and an awfully concerted ideological campaign, if you like, before people could be brought to accept usury as a permissible practice at all. So I think that instinctively people are resistant to the kind of unnatural effects, because I think Aristotle was absolutely right when he said that usury was unnatural. I think people are naturally resistant to it, and I don't think it would take very much. And I think perhaps this present credit crisis might possibly be enough to reawaken people's ancient suspicions and hostility towards usury.
That's the voice of David Hawkes. He's a professor of English at Arizona State University. His most recent book is The Culture of Usury in Renaissance England. He's also written books like Ideology and John Milton, A Hero of Our Time. You can read him in the Times Literary Supplement as well. We have links on againstthegrain.org.
Now, I hope you found that interview as inspiring and refreshing as I did. I'm going to be listening to it again because it's got some quite new perspectives on money, and I want to become more familiar with those patterns of thinking. Now we're going to have a look at how money affects individuals.
This is an audio version of a presentation called What Economics Can't Tell You About Money, and it's number AE605, so you could Google on that, or you could get it straight from altruists.org/AE605. My name's Robin Upton, and I published this in January 2011. Having the graphics will definitely help you understand it, but I'm making it for a radio audience, so I hope you'll be able to understand a lot of it anyway. It's in five sections, and I'm going over a set of research which is not done by economists. So these are mainly results from other disciplines, sociology, advertising, looking incidentally at discoveries about how money affects people's minds, how it affects their decision making, but this is about the real world effect of money on people. And strange as it may seem, economics doesn't generally look at that. Economics is more about models, about mathematical assumptions. And this is in five sections, and the first one is called Money as Motivation. Now, economics assumes everybody wants more money. Whatever you're offering people, economics assumes if you sweeten it with enough money, people will go for that. So, this incidental result from a US blood bank from 1973 is an interesting one in that context, because they had a list of former donors, and they asked the donors, would you like to give blood again? But they split them into two groups. Group A were asked a simple question, would you like to give blood again? And 93% of people said, yeah, all right, I'll come along and give blood. Group B said, would you like to give blood again? And if you do so, we'll give you a $10 reward. So, if you're asked to give blood again, 93% of people said yes. If you're asked to give blood again and offered an extra $10 for doing so, what percentage do you think would say, yeah, we'll do that? Well, it was 65. So, second example. In Wolfenschiessen, Switzerland, in the 1990s, adult residents were asked about citing a local nuclear waste processing facility, considering it has to be built somewhere, and this is a suitable place, would you support its construction? 51% of people said, all right, you can plant it here, we won't mind. Now, the local government thought 51% of people, that's a fairly thin majority, I think we better sweeten the deal, we'll offer people some compensation, a bonus, because it is a bit of a health risk. So they were asked, would you support its construction if we give you a reward for doing so, of up to $8,700? So, if 51% of people said yes, without the money, given the reward, the number of people plummeted to 25. So that is not what economics expects. How does money work as a disincentive? This is in the real world. In economics, of course, it's always an incentive. Everybody always wants more money. In the real world, money crowds out other motives. When people think about money, they adopt a selfish mentality. So the blood donors were thinking, $10, and I've got to go there, and I've got to take some of my blood out, that sounds painful, and perhaps I'll be without blood for a while, that's going to disturb me, all for a measly $10, perhaps I won't bother this time. So that was when they were thinking about money.